Read from text 143 to 148. 148 has a purport, but we're going to be focusing mostly on 143, so we're going to read that together. Veda Shastra Kahe Sambandha Abhideya Prayojana. Krishna Krishna Bhakti Prematina Mahadana. Okay, just looking at the Bengali, what is this verse about? Very simple Bengali. There's knowledge about Sambandha, Abhideva, and Prayojana in the Shastra, and Tina, what does Tina mean? No, Tina in Bengali. When you go around Radhakund and Shamakund, you come to the teen samadhis, right by there's a path parallel to the path going to Jiva Mandir, and if you go down that way, you pass the turn for Krishna Das Kaviraj's Bhajan Kutir, you go towards Gopalbhatta, Goswami's Kutir, and right in front of you there are the teen samadhis of Krishna Das Kaviraj, Raghunath Das Goswami, Raghunath Bhatta Goswami. So what does teen mean? If they're Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami, Raghunath Das Goswami, Raghunath Bhatta Samadhi, they're called the teen samadhis. Yeah, three. Then you have Mahadhana. What's Dhana? It's connected to charity. It's what you usually give in charity. What do you usually give in charity? Money. So dana means money. And mahadana? Lots of money. Okay, so there's three big monies here. What are the three big monies? And prema. Krishna, Krishna, bhakti, and prema. Now, it's interesting that up till this point, we've had a lot of money analogies and wealth analogies. In the verse just previous to this, it says, daridra nasa. What does daridra mean? Poor. Nasha? Not poor. Nasha, vinashaya, to do skritam. Destroy. To destroy poverty. Okay, then we have the couple verses previous to that, we have another dana. Dhanapali, when one gets rich. So we have this analogy, this metaphor is being carried over here, that you get rich and you get rid of poverty. So what are the three big riches that you get? Krishna, Krishna, bhakti, and prema. And that's the essence of Sambandha Abhideya Prayojana. That Sambandha being Krishna, you know, your relationships with Krishna, Abhideya being Krishna bhakti, the process of serving Krishna, and prema is your prayojana. And then Mahaprabhu is going to be discussing Krishna for the rest of this chapter, chapter 20, and all of chapter 21. Then he's going to be discussing Krishna bhakti, or Krishna's service, for all of chapter 22. And then he's going to be discussing prema, or love of Krishna, in chapter 23, and that will conclude the discussion. So sometimes we get lost, especially we're just reading once a week, and we may concentrate on one or two lines from a purport, and then sometimes it's hard to find the organization of the teacher that's going on here. The teacher here is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, not me. So what I would like to do, this is a little aside, what I'd really like to do for our upcoming educational degree at some point, I don't know if we'll have time to do it in the next 6 weeks, but what I'd really like to do would be to look at the Shastra and see, how does Mahaprabhu teach? How does Krishna teach? And then how did the Acharyas Narada Muni, Srila Prabhupada, Bhaktisiddhanta, Maitreya, how do they teach? So here we're seeing that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he's teaching by using an analogy, by using a metaphor, very common. He's using a metaphor of wealth, that this knowledge is like wealth, and great wealth. And then he's also giving first, this is what we were taught a long time ago, tell him what you're going to tell him, and then tell him what you told him. So first he's giving an overview, just like in the book there's a table of contents. And so first he's giving an overview that the three subjects I'm going to talk about are Krishna, Krishna Bhakti, and Prema. And then he's going to devote a whole long time to Krishna, then some time to Krishna Bhakti, and then some time to Prema. So for the rest of this chapter and for chapter 21, Mahaprabhu is going to be discussing Krishna in order to establish the Sambandha. Okay, so we're going to read the translation for this, and we're going to go through 48. Translation. In the Vedic literatures, Krishna is the central point of attraction, and his service is our activity. To attain the platform of love of Krishna is life's ultimate goal. What did Prabhupada just explain from the verse? Therefore, Krishna, Krishna's service, and love of Krishna are the three great riches of life. Text 44. So, now what's Mahaprabhu going to talk about now? He told you there were three topics. Now what topic again is he going to talk about? Krishna. So now we're beginning Mahaprabhu's discussion about Krishna. So he's going to be establishing who is Krishna, which is our sambandha, to establish a relationship with Krishna, from the Shastra. And he's going to go through a whole description. I was thinking it'd be really nice to map out these couple chapters. I think Pranada has done a little service with that. He's going to describe who is Krishna from the Shastra, and then he's going to describe all of Krishna's incarnations, all the different kinds of Krishna's incarnate, different categories, and within the different categories, all of the lists. Basically, just to establish that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that our ultimate relationship is with Krishna, and to really establish at least just a basic framework of Krishna's glories. Okay, so here in text 44, Mahaprabhu says, Ved Adi Sakala Shastre Krishna Mukya Sambandha. So Ved Adi, in the Vedas and their corollaries, Sakala, all of them, Shastra, in all the Shastras, Krishna, Mukya Sambandha. Mukya means, anyone know what Mukya means? Mouth or face, and it can also mean the chief, the primary, just like we use the word head like that, the head of the class, the head of the institution. So they use the word face, meaning the chief. In all revealed, this is the translation for text 144, in all revealed scriptures, beginning with the Vedas, the central point of attraction is Krishna. When complete knowledge of him is realized, the bondage of Maya, the illusory energy, is automatically broken. So Mahaprabhu is establishing two things, that we know that Krishna is the Sambandha by looking at the Shastras. And of course, he established this in this first verse, Veda Shastra Kahe. So he's not, when Mahaprabhu is giving his introduction, this is an introductory verse. This is like, again, like a table of contents. And he led up to it. We could also see the verses going before this 143, which is, 143 is a really pivotal verse. Mahaprabhu's inciting the desire in Sanatana Goswami and all of us who will listen later by explaining some of the benefits one will get by having this knowledge. And here again, he's giving a benefit. He's saying, how do we know Krishna is a Sambandha? Well, first of all, from all of the Shastras, Vedadi, Sakala Shastra. Because here he's just saying Veda Shastra. Now he's expanding on it in the next one. All of the Shastras. And they're saying Krishna is the chief Mukya Sambandha. There may be other, we're not denying Brahmeti, Paramatmeti, Bhagavaniti, Subjite. There's other forms of the Absolute Truth. But of all the forms, Krishna is the highest. Prabhupada coined this English term, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Right, I was had some communication for the course I'm preparing for, the module, I haven't used proper European terms, for the module I'm preparing for, and I was speaking with one scholar who's a former member of ISKCON, and I said, you know, why did you give up Krishna? And he said, well, I haven't given up Krishna. I still have some pictures of him in my house. He He says, but I'm not sure that he's the highest level of divinity. So, of course, different people may go to different aspects of the divine. That's in the Vedas. Frankly, it's even in the Bhagavatam. That one can approach different levels. One can approach the Brahman, the Paramatma. One can approach Lord Narayan. One can approach Kurma, Varaha, Nasinga, Ramachandra, Dwarkadish Krishna, Mathuradish Krishna, or Nandaraj, Yasoda Nandaraj's son, Krishna. And Mahaprabhu, at least, is establishing that Krishna is the ultimate form of Sambandha. And what is the result? So this is his first point, that Krishna is the ultimate form of Sambandha according to the Shastras. There may be other forms of Sambandha, but Krishna is the head, he's the chief. And then what is the benefit? That you lose the bond of illusion. Okay, text 145. I'm not going to read the Bengali for this. There are many types of Vedic literatures and supplementary Puranas. So here, Mahaprabhu is anticipating an argument for the other side, which is one thing that you need to do if you're going to be putting forward some point. And Jai Dwaita Marsh told me you have to always anticipate the strongest argument on the other side and defeat that, not that you put forward your strongest arguments and just defeat the opposition's weakest arguments. That's cheating. And then you won't be prepared for their strongest arguments. So here Mahaprabhu is anticipating what somebody may say. This is a verse from the Padma Purana, Prabhupada says in the purport. There are many types of Vedic literatures and supplementary Puranas. In each of them, there are particular demigods who are spoken of as the chief demigods. So somebody may say, well, in different scriptures, different personalities are put forward as the chief. Mahaprabhu goes on to say, this is just to create an illusion for moving and non-moving living entities. Let them perpetually engage in such imaginations. However, when one analytically studies all these Vedic literatures collectively, he comes to the conclusion that Lord Vishnu is the one and only Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this is a very important point for those of us who read the Shastras. That if you take a particular Shastra, a particular quote from a Shastra as it is, just one sentence or one verse, out of context, and you try to use that one sentence or that one verse to establish something as ultimate, that you may be misled. When Prabhupada says here, by analytically studying all these Vedic literatures collectively, so one has to understand the Shastra collectively. Therefore, we really strongly suggest that one read all of Prabhupada's books, and preferably more than once, and read them with some deep study and meditation to understand what is the total Siddhanta, not just what is one point being made here, one point being made there. Just like, as I said the other day, I was putting together this paper on what is ISKCON for the GBC website, and you can find Srila Prabhupada giving different definitions of what is the purpose of ISKCON. And some of them are quite different from one another. They're from quite a different perspective. And you could easily take just one of them and say, well, that's it. That's the whole purpose of ISKCON. And any other purpose of ISKCON is not valid. But you want to take everything together. And I'd say particularly you want to look for statements that are never contradicted. If there are certain things that the Shastra says or the Acharyas say, and they consistently say the same thing on the same point, they never say anything different, then you understand, okay, this is a universally applicable truth. This is applicable in all times and places and circumstances and to all people. Bhaktivinoda Thakur delineated 9 of those, the 10th being that the source of truth is the Shastra. And then there are other things you'll see that they're true, they're absolutely true, but they're absolutely true in some contexts. They're not relative truths, but they're still contextual. They still depend on the context for understanding. You can't take them and say, okay, this applies to everybody all the time. So this is a very important point. If you want to know what is the supreme destination, what's the highest destination, you have to study the Shastra in toto. And it's not mentioned here, but under the guidance of somebody who has realization. Okay, going on to 146. When one accepts the Vedic literature by interpretation or even by dictionary meaning, Directly or indirectly, the ultimate declaration of Vedic knowledge points to Lord Krishna. So here Mahaprabhu is saying, doesn't matter how you do it. He says, mukhya gona vritti. Mukhya is chief, gona is secondary. It doesn't matter. Anvaya vyatireke, whether you take directly or indirectly, whether you take the literal meaning, whether you take an interpretive meaning, it's still going to bring you to the same conclusion that Krishna is supreme. Okay, 148. Lord Krishna said, what is the purpose of all Vedic literatures? On whom do they focus? Who is the object of all speculation? Outside of me, no one knows these things. Now you should know that all these activities are aimed at ordaining and setting forth me. The purpose of the Vedic literatures is to know me by different speculations, either by indirect understanding or by dictionary understanding. Everyone is speculating about me. The essence of all Vedic literatures is to distinguish me from Maya. By considering the illusory energy, one comes to the platform of understanding me. In this way, one becomes free from speculation about the Vedas and comes to me as the conclusion. Thus, one is satisfied. Purport. These two verses are quoted from Srimad Bhagavatam 11:21, 42-43. When Uddhava asked Krishna about the purpose of Vedic speculation, the Lord informed him of the process of understanding the Vedic literature. The Vedas are composed of karma kanda, jnana karma, and upasana kanda. One who analytically studies the purpose of the Vedas understands that by karma kanda, sacrificial activity, one comes to the conclusion of jnana kanda, speculative knowledge, and that after speculation, one comes to the conclusion that worship of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the ultimate. When one comes to this conclusion, he becomes fully satisfied. So that's the end of this verse, is prasiddhiti, to become satisfied. So Mahaprabhu is giving several evidences. One, this is what the Shastra says. If you take the Shastra as a whole, and whether you study the Shastra directly, indirectly, by the dictionary, by interpretation, this is what you're going to get from the Shastra. Another argument he gives is you're going to break the bonds of Maya. And another argument he gives is you're going to become fully satisfied. Okay, let's go back to 143. And Mahaprabhu's metaphor is one of, what's his metaphor? Wealth. Riches. So everybody wants wealth, at least everybody that I've met. I'm sure there's a few people who don't care. There's one gentleman who lives on the street, literally on the street, on the Parikram path in Vrindavan. He doesn't seem to care about wealth very much. He owns literally nothing. I mean, he lives there naked, and people give him blankets, and the dogs share his blankets, and when the blankets get really old, and which doesn't take very long on the street on the Parikram path, somebody gives him another blanket. And so, I don't know what he does in the rainy season, but that's what he has. All he has is a blanket, which charitable people replace, and he has the company of the dogs and sometimes the monkeys and the pigs, who at night squish up to him to get warm, and people give him food and water and etc. And so I don't think that man's interested in wealth. But generally speaking, most people are interested in wealth. I think most of us here, if somebody offered us some money, we probably would accept it. Isn't that correct? Probably. Okay. So here Mahaprabhu is saying the three great riches. And people want to have that which is most valuable. They're looking for something that has the greatest value. And here he's saying, what are the three things that have the greatest value? It's knowing about your sambandha abhideya prayojana, knowing what is our ultimate relationship with, who am I, what's my identity, what do I do to realize that identity, and what happens after I realize that identity? What's the result of realizing my identity? So here he's saying the sambandha is Krishna, that I have a relationship with Krishna. I have an eternal relationship with Krishna. You know, whatever we're doing in life is based on identity. So I probably should have done this yesterday instead of that I'm planning on working on it today. But one of the lessons in our upcoming course is on identity and how a religious organization, any religious organization in general, but ISKCON in particular, helps to form one's identity. And we start out looking at the importance of identity in making decisions. I mean, we may think, well, the way I make decisions is I consider the pros and cons, and I think about what the result might be and how much work I'm going to have to do to get that result. And, you know, I look at all the factors in sort of a detached, logical way, and that's how I make my decisions. But research shows that that's not true at all. That the main way we make our decisions is based on identity. We decide, who am I? And then, okay, what is the ideal form of somebody like me do in this situation? And that's how we make our decisions. So we decide, okay, I'm a, you know, old Bengali housewife. So what do old Bengali housewives do in this situation? Oh, this is what they do. So that's what I should do. And that's how we decide everything. I was visiting some devotees some months ago, and they were eating at the kitchen table, and the husband says to his wife, you know, we've been married just a couple years, and people can understand that we're still eating off the kitchen table, but after we're married for 5 years, you know, people will expect us to have a dining room table. So I thought, what's the basis of that? That's thinking I'm a middle-class American. You know, a middle-class American married man is supposed to have a dining room table by the fourth year of marriage. That's what's expected. And frankly, we all do the same thing. You know, that's if we analyze, how do I decide what I'm going to do? It all starts with identity. Therefore, Prabhupada asked one time to some disciples, how do you preach? They said, we preach that there's a God and that Krishna is God. Prabhupada said, no, first you should preach that you're not this body. Because it makes a huge difference. If I think, you know, okay, I'm a middle-aged, almost old American lady, then I'm going to make certain decisions. And if I think I'm a soul, I'm not this body, I'm going to make quite different decisions. And then if I think, well, I'm a soul, I'm not this body, what am I? I'm Krishna's servant. I'm Prabhupada's servant. Now, then I'm going to make a certain kind of decision. That's going to decide my ethics, my morality. It's going to decide what I spend my money on, what I spend my time on, who I associate with, what I choose to do, what I consider to be fulfilling. Everything is going to come from this sambandha. So the basis of our sambandha is going to be our relationship with Krishna. Now, how do I know that that's my identity? Right? How do I know? Well, Mahaprabhu is saying, I'm going to know from the Shastra. I mean, you can know a little bit just from empiricism. You can figure out from empiricism that you're not this body if you're a little thoughtful. Because, you know, if I look at pictures of my body 20 years ago, they're hardly recognizable. What to speak of what I anticipating looking like in 20 years if I hang around in this body that long? You know, you won't be able to recognize it. If you ever look through some of you have gone to your parents' houses for the holidays, you know, if you look through the old photo albums, like, oh, Grandpa used to look like that. Right? It's completely different. Why don't you speak of the baby body? You know, that's you wouldn't be able to match up. They have those sort of contests sometimes, right? Baby pictures matching up. You couldn't do it. So just empirically, we can understand that my body's undergone radical changes, and even science says that all the cells in the body have changed, but I have a continuing sense of identity, which the philosophers can't figure out, by the way. If you take classes in philosophy, they say, how is it that we have a continuing sense of identity? And they really don't have any clue as to what that is, and our mind is changing also. So just even a little empiricism, I know I must be different from this body, and then there's all sorts of empiric evidence of people who have out-of-body experiences. So just on the basis of empiricism, I can understand I'm not this. Right? Na jayate, na mriyate. I'm not born. I don't die. I'm not this. I can't be cut. I can't be burned. I can't be moistened by water. I can't be withered by the wind. But that doesn't tell you what you are. It just tells you what you're not. So So how do you know what you are? Well, that's a little difficult through empiricism. You know, I can have some idea that I must be a being who wants unlimited pleasure. That I can figure out also through empiricism. I can figure out I must be a being who wants knowledge, and I must be a being who wants vital life. I must be a being who wants Satchitananda. That I can also figure out through empiricism. I can figure out there must be some kind of master of the world who's a lot smarter than I am. What else can I figure out through empiricism about that person? That must be one. It couldn't be a committee. All committees have a leader. It must be someone who's very interested in variety and individuality, who has a lot of creative force. Someone who's interested in order, but not absolute order. There's some factor of randomness or spontaneity in the world as well. So, you know, there's an absolute order, there's seasons, there's the way the planets move, but you can't just say, you can't predict the weather 5 years in advance. There's some degree of spontaneity, so some mix of order and spontaneity. There's definitely some rules, mathematics and physics and chemistry, but then there's also emotions. And there's the emotions are, again, they have some unpredictable, spontaneous nature to them. So I can understand that much about the ultimate reality. But there's a limit as to how far I can get. So therefore, I have to go to Shabda, just with Anuman and Pratyaksha, just with my sense perception and my logic. I reach a limit as to what I can understand about who am I. What am I a part of? Who is God? So therefore, Mahaprabhu is saying we have to go to the Shastras. And we have to go to the authorities. Now, of course, this begs the question, who's in authority? How do I know who's in authority? Now, even materially, how do I know who's in authority? Recently, I had some devotee I don't know writing me and asking me questions and then telling me I don't know what I'm talking about. And then I wrote back to him and I said, if you don't think I know what I'm talking about, why are you asking me questions? You know, saying, how can I improve my japa? How can I improve this in my life? And then saying, well, really, you don't know anything. It's okay. So how do we... I couldn't quite figure that one out. So how do we decide? I mean, maybe, you know, we may like test, well, does this person really know? Does that person really know? What's our ultimate test as to whether or not we've really found an authority? And Mahaprabhu, just in these verses for today, is giving a few. Anybody remember what tests Mahaprabhu gives? You mentioned them. Yes? Yes, those are our authorities. But how do we know? Free from illusory bonds. She got to go open it. Here, Mahaprabhu is just talking about Shastra and these particular verses. He's only talking about Shastra. So how we know is we'll get free from the bonds of illusion. And what else? What was the other test? Full satisfaction. Right? And he's quoting Krishna himself from the 11th canto, which reminds us of Savai Pum Samparo Dharmo Yato Bhaktir Hokshaje Ahoituki Aprityata Yadyatya Suprasiditi, because Krishna's using the same words. Prasiditi. One must become fully satisfied. So our ultimate test of who is a bona fide authority is what results we get. I mean, we can talk about, and we do talk about, how that these shastras came about at the beginning of the universe from the breathing of Lord Narayana, that they're eternal, that they've been passed down from a chain of disciplic succession. We list the most important persons, not nearly all of the persons, by the way, but we list the most important persons in our disciplic succession. And we can give that kind of evidence. But again, that begs the question, how do I know that's true? I mean, what am I going to do? Even in a normal history book, when they say that, you know, there was a Napoleon or there was a George Washington or there was an Alexander the Great, I mean, how do I know that's true? How can I test that? Maybe somebody made it up. I mean, I don't really have any means of testing it. You know, in the ordinary schools, they also have a parampara. You've learned from your professor, they've learned from their professor, they've learned from their professor, and these are their history textbooks. But, you know, there are governments who change the history books. What to say? And in America, you know, we had a civil war And so the history books of the North and the history books of the South are a little different. I'm sure if you go to the UK, the history books about the Revolutionary War are different. They probably even call it a different name. Like the history books in the southern part of America, they don't call it the Civil War. They call it the War Between the States. So if any of you are British, what do they call the Revolutionary War? Any Britishers here? What do they call the Revolutionary War between England and the colonies? They have a different name for it than probably. The Nonsense Breakaways, yes. Even now the Britishers have a little derisive attitude toward the Americans, you know. Much more so than the Americans have toward the British, by the way. It's quite interesting. You know, oh, those are the rebellious teenagers, you know, who had a war to break away from the mother country. They couldn't do it in a civilized way like the Canadians and the Australians and the New Zealanders, you know. They had to have a war. So my point is that history books are going to appear differently. One's view of knowledge is going to appear differently. I mean, how do I know just because Srila Prabhupada, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta said this is our parampara and this is the breathing of Narayana? I mean, look, there's so many groups in the world who are going to claim that they have authentic knowledge that's come from some revealed source. How do you ultimately know? So there should be a test. One should be becoming free from illusion and one should be becoming satisfied. You know, if it's the actual authorized thing, then it works. How do you know you have good medicine? You get better. You know, there are people who sell phony medicine, and the phony medicine sellers will also tell you, oh, this is authorized. And you can't even just always tell by the price. You know, sometimes the phony stuff is sold at a higher price. That's not always indicative. But you see, do I get better? Do other people who are taking this medicine, do they also get better? So this is our evidence procedure. We should be able to distinguish, as Mahaprabhu says here, that we should actually, quoting Krishna. Of course, Mahaprabhu is Krishna, but anyway. He's saying that we should be able to distinguish Krishna from illusion. So this, of course, is a prime part of getting free from illusion. In order to get free from illusion, I have to know what is Krishna and what is Maya. What is Krishna and what is Maya? I have to be able to tell the difference between them. And then I have to be able to get free from them. The way one gets free from Maya is by seeing Maya for what it is. And seeing Krishna for what he is. Okay, then it's also explained here, Srila Prabhupada's explaining, we talked about this at length the other day in Bhagavatam class. I'm not going to go through it more than briefly right now, that the Vedic Shastras also give different steps, because one could argue, well, in the Vedic Shastras, there's so many different identities given and so many different processes given. They don't just give one process. And from my perspective, that's the beauty of the Vedas. I don't see how you could have, as a world religion, for a long period of time, any religious system that has, there's one way for everybody, and that's it only. You know, as I said the other day, if you're going to make that kind of statement, then very quickly, your one way is going to become very broad and wishy-washy and watered down, because you're going to be propounding something that only a few people can do. And so you're going to make it some meaningless thing. That, okay, our one way is just to say, I believe in Jesus. I accept him as my Savior. Done. That's absurd. That would be the essence of religion, just to make some sort of statement of theoretical belief. So the Vedas don't do that. The Vedas give different paths for different people. They give different ultimate objects. They put forward here different demigods as an ultimate object of worship. And the key to understanding that's the only way that you can engage everybody. You have to engage different people according to their levels. There's just no other option. You know, you can try for another option, but it won't work for very long. I mean, frankly, even in our Hare Krishna movement, you know, we tried in the beginning of our movement to say everybody had to live exactly the same way, and it didn't work. As ISKCON is growing, we're seeing different people need to live in different ways. That we have different levels of membership. I'm looking at one presentation by Charu Prabhu of Utah, where he talks about, I think, five different levels of membership and commitment. I think it just of all the different, and I've seen a lot of the different materials about membership, I find his to be the most brilliant. So he's really engaging people where they are. And even people who can come to the highest standard, they may be engaged differently. Some of them may be living in the temple and taking a lot of responsibility. Some may be living in the temple as helpers. Some may be living in ISKCON-owned property. Some may be living on their own and so forth. Now here, the progression given in this purport to 148, we see that these different, and this dealt with your question of the other day, that these different paths are not really different. They're different steps on the same path. And where you are means what will help you to take the next step. It doesn't mean I'm at this place that I stay here. That's not the meaning of the different steps. And here Prabhupada's saying how karmakanda leads to jnanakanda leads to upasanakanda. That the purpose of karmakanda is to take you to jnanakarma. The purpose of jnanakanda is to take you to upasanakanda. So this is very nicely explained. Again, we don't really have the time to get into it. But this is very nicely explained in the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. And what's interesting there is even 5,000 years ago, Lord Sri Krishna was not advising a gradual step-by-step path through karmakanda, jnanakanda, and upasanakanda. Although that's there. It's there, just like Krishna's not recommending the path of going through the demigods. Although that's there. You know, if someone insists, okay, here's another path for you. If someone says, okay, I just can't do Krishna Bhakti, I don't like Krishna, I want somebody else, we don't say, all right, you're out of the Vedic system. We say, that's not a very good idea. No, this is what I want. It's not a very good idea. No, this is what I want. Okay, here you go, and you're still in the Vedas. You're still within the boundary of the Vedas. Isn't that nice? Nobody has to become a heretic. Nobody has to be outside. You know, you can accommodate everybody. It's so nice. Although you can say, no, this is not a recommended path. It's going to be a long, slow process. It may not take you where you want to go. It's going to be harder to take the next step from that way. But okay, there you go. This is for you. So to go through this process, which is very nicely explained in the 12th chapter, and Prabhupada elucidates on it in many places, where first you perform varnashram for your own sense gratification, to enjoy a nice material world. And if you perform varnashram nicely, you will enjoy a nice material world, however much the material world can be nice, which isn't very much. But you'll get that. You'll get your drops of water in the desert. Now, there are, we do admit, the material world has some drops of water. It does. It's whatever to say. So you'll get that if you do your varnashram duties perfectly and you're enjoying the fruits. And at a certain point you say, these aren't very tasty fruits. I'm working really, really hard. And, you know, we're talking going back to riches. I'm not getting much money for it. You know, my first real job, other than babysitting, was I was a baker in a Marriott hotel. They were paying me in those days $2 an hour. So I concluded after a couple months of that, that it wasn't worth it. That the amount of work I had to put in and the amount of money that I got, plus I was so exhausted I didn't have time to enjoy the money. You know, after working so hard, it was like all I wanted to do on the weekend was go to sleep. And I thought, this is not life. So one eventually comes to that point. You know, okay, I have 52 weeks a year, I work 50 weeks, I have a vacation 2 weeks. Huh. It's really not, and then on my vacation it may rain, or I may get sick, you know, or my kids may get sick, or something happens, I get in a fight with my wife on my vacation. So even those 2 weeks may not really be enjoyable. If I really start putting on the scale, you know, okay, how much tapasya do I have to do? And how much pleasure do I get? And you look at it and you go, that's a really bad cost, you know, what is it, cost-benefit ratio there. And then so then you go on beyond karmakanda and you come to karmapala tyag, giving up the working. You're still working in varnashram, but you're giving up the fruits of your work. Now you're working for purification. You're working for liberation. And then you start entering into this jnanakanda. and in Gyanakanda you're studying Vedanta, you're studying the Upanishads, and you're becoming a philosopher. Prabhupada uses the word here, speculation. But you're engaging in philosophical speculation, not just wild, unbounded mental speculation. And you come to see, oh, this material world is an illusion, it's Maya, and I'm a soul, and I should be working for liberation. I should be working for purification. I shouldn't be working for a few drops. I should be working for the ocean. Let me merge into the ocean. So when one gets fixed in jnana karma, then one stops identifying with the things of this world. And then one comes to yoga, one comes to dhyana, where one can meditate on the self. And that step is sort of included here in upasana khanda. And one sees the Lord within the heart. And one starts to get some affinity for the Lord. And then from that point, one starts to think, oh, the Supreme is a person. Let me engage in bhakti. Let me engage in service. So that's the long path through the Vedas, which Arjuna asked at the beginning of chapter 12. Is it good to take that path? So the answer is quite clearly no. It's not good to take that path. But the path exists. It exists and one can go on that path. Why not good to take that path? Well, it's a long, hard one. And you may get very distracted on the way because it takes a long, long time before you get your riches. You know, just like there are some careers, they say the worst is a college professor. Between the time you start and the time you get your fruit. You know, you have to get your bachelor's degree, then your master's degree, then your PhD. And then you have to be producing some research and get published. And then you come in first, you know, as just like a visiting professor or just an untenured professor. And then it takes you another 10 years at least to get tenure. You all know what tenure is? Tenure when you can't be fired. You know, when you're actually a real professor. So by the time you finish all that, you're probably 40. Or maybe 45. So, you know, you've started, and if you figure that your education starts when you're 5, or when you're 3, maybe, and then you don't really reach the goal of your profession until you're 40 or 45. So they say that the tenured professor is the worst profession for women, biologically. Because if a woman takes time out to have a baby in that, then she may never become tenured. Or she may not become tenured until she's 50. They say so. Therefore, a lot of women professors have no children or only one child that they have very late in life. And the second worst profession for women biologically is medical doctor, which is very similar. But you could become a medical doctor by the time you're 30 or 33, you know, even in a specialty. So it's a little younger. So this long path to bhakti is something like that. It's something like becoming a tenured professor. You know, you're working really, 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 really hard for a long, long, long time before you see any fruit, you know. By the time you see a fruit of becoming a tenured professor, you're already old. you're already, you know, you finally got to your goal and then you're already looking at retirement. So that path is not recommended, whereas the path of bhakti, what you take to bhakti in the beginning, is what's being recommended. So therefore, Mahaprabhu is saying, if you really want the mahadhana, if you really want the great riches, then immediately take to Krishna. Don't get distracted by the demigods. Don't get distracted by the path of karmakanda, jnanakanda, jnanakanda, upasanakanda. Don't go in that long, windy road. You know, go right to Krishna. Then you will get the great riches of life. And you can get those great riches fairly quickly. Right? Who was asking? Were you asking about the immediate? Is that you? Somebody was asking. He's not here. No, it was one. Somebody. It was somebody over there who was asking. I remember the geography. I don't remember the face. We were sitting right there. Yeah, some boy who was sitting right there is asking about how is it we say it's a gradual process, but yet it's immediate. So actually, with bhakti, one does get something immediately. Right? We find this. I was just reading a wonderful thing. One of my god sisters in Florida, she was saying how her father and mother came to visit for a Christmas holiday, and they went to her daughter's house where they were having a kirtan. I mean, like a 2-hour bhajan and kirtan. And her father wrote something about his experience in the kirtan. And although he's not a devotee, he probably isn't even a vegetarian, he was describing how it was the most wonderful experience of his life. And how he was transported to another realm. I remember my father saying a similar thing at my oldest son, Janu's father's grain ceremony, where we had, in those days in ISKCON, unfortunately the grihasthas were not very much loved. So we couldn't have the grain ceremony in the temple. We had to have it in our apartment. And somehow we were able to, Agni Dev was able to commandeer some of the Sunday feast prasadam, so we brought that to our house, because it was Maya in those days to do your own cooking. So anyway, we only had one little pot for heating up milk. So we brought over the Sunday feast prasadam, and at least all the grihastha devotees we brought over. And maybe that was must have been before the press moved out to L.A., because after that there were like no grihastha devotees. Anyway, we had big kirtan that went on and on and on in our house. And then prasadam and a couple of devotees spoke. And my father came to me and he said, "This is the most wonderful experience I've ever had in my life." So even a beginner in bhakti, you know, another example, I might have given this here before. We were in Germany for a Pandavasena retreat. And there was one American, he must have been already in his 30s, who was just traveling around like a backpacker kind of guy. And he had decided to come by the temple and check it out. So he stayed there maybe 5-6 days, happened to be there, and we had this big festival going on. So at first we were just like preaching to him. He was especially interested in social and political issues. We were talking about a perfect society in Varnashram. And after maybe day 3 or 4, he said, "I'd like to try chanting." So someone lent him some beads, and he came back after a half an hour, and he said, "That should be a controlled substance." So with bhakti, one can get some freedom from illusion and some sense of satisfaction, even in the very beginning. Whereas in the long, 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 long path, it's all just, you know, some hope in the future, if I manage to make it. So this is the great riches of our life. Krishna, understanding Krishna, which we're going to be going through, I would imagine, for the next many, many months, through this chapter and the next chapter. Krishna, service to Krishna, and love of Krishna. So how do we tell what are the riches in our life? I mean, we're all agreeing with this theoretically, yes. Krishna, service to Krishna, and love of Krishna. Those are the three great riches in my life. Yes. But we can see what we really consider the riches in our life. But where do we put our time and energy? Now, do we really put our time and energy into meditating on Krishna? That we have to see, because we're going to be very carefully protecting whatever we feel is the greatest riches in our lives. And I've told the story many, many times, but it was such one of those events that greatly impacted me. How when I was taking my students on a field trip, on the way back we saw great billowing clouds of smoke. There was an apartment building, an 8-apartment building on fire. And when finally the fire department came and the flames died down a little, we went up to the building, and there was this young woman standing on the sidewalk barefoot with her 3 young children. That when the building went up in flames, she grabbed her children. She didn't put on her shoes, she didn't grab her wallet, she didn't grab her family heirlooms, she grabbed her children. And I thought, yes, this is what it is. How do you know what your real treasures are? Therefore, the time of death, yam yam vapi sram bhavam tvaja chante kalevram tam tam eva dikanteya sadatad bhava bhavita. We can say, yes, Krishna is the greatest treasure in my life. But if we're dying, what will we grab? You know, that's the test. We can say anything. And we can put on a show for the other devotees. That's not hard. I mean, people have done that sometimes for 20, 30 years before we find out they have another secret treasure hidden away somewhere. No, but that's how we know what's our real treasure. Notice, what does my anxiety go to? What do I worry about? The residents of Vrindavan, they were worrying about Krishna. And they're worrying about Krishna to the point of, you know, is he going to step on a little pebble on the path? That was the level of their anxiety about Krishna. Mother Yasoda was thinking, I'll give my life millions of times so that Krishna won't get one drop of perspiration. That was her level of anxiety for Krishna. You know, and we have, believe me, we have that level of anxiety in our lives. It's not that we don't. But what is it about? Is it about my money? Is it about my clothes? Is it about my relationship with certain key people in my life? I may have that level of anxiety about my relationship with my husband, with my wife, with my children, with my temple president, with the head of my department, with the people that I interact with, that I feel these are the people that are crucial for giving me what I want. I may have that level of anxiety about my situation in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Am I saying the right thing? Am I dressing the right way? Am I doing the right thing so that they'll still give me that nice porridge in the morning? Yeah. I mean, what is our level of anxiety about? Do I have a lot of anxiety about this body? You know, am I constantly worrying about my health? Okay, I've got to take this medicine and that medicine and this kind of food. And am I just totally absorbed in my diet and my medicine and my exercise and my, you know, pillow and my whatever I'm doing for my health? Where is my anxiety going to? If there's some danger, what am I going to protect? So this is how we can tell what we really believe. You know, what is the gap between my espoused philosophy and my real philosophy? So if we are at least theoretically convinced that this is our great riches, then we should do whatever we can during the day to cultivate that. Right? If I have something that's very, very valuable, then I should be protecting it and meditating on how to protect it. Therefore, I should be meditating on Krishna. Actually meditating on Krishna. Not just the service I have to do for Krishna, but actually Krishna. Therefore, we have this deity worship. So we can be meditating, what's Radha Gopinath wearing today? Right? What are they eating today? Are they eating nicely? I mean, like, meditate on what I'm eating. What am I going to eat? What are they going to make for breakfast today? Are they going to make pancakes again? Or are they just going to make porridge? Or is it going to be bread? Oh, the bread the other day was kind of old, and I wonder if I'm going to get anything good to eat. But we can meditate on what Radha Gopinath's eating. Just like Madhavendra Puri was doing that, you know, what's being offered? What's being offered to the deities? What's being offered? Actually, it was also Gopinath deity. And I can meditate on their pastimes. One of my friends recently asked me about how will Krishna talk to you? So I've been really meditating on that. How many times Srila Prabhupada says that Krishna is eager to talk to you. And then I thought, how much of my day do I spend talking to him? You know, I keep waiting for him to talk to me. It's like, why aren't you talking to me? Why aren't you talking to me? And he's saying, well, why aren't you talking to me? You know, if I have relationships in this world that I consider to be my treasures, that I would be really devastated if they were gone, some family or friends, or, you know, if that person were to die or that person were to leave me, or just if that person were to be angry with me, that I would feel devastated. And I make some effort, I put some energy into maintaining my relationship with that person. So how much energy am I putting into maintaining my relationship with Krishna? Do I come and talk to him? And do I talk to him? When I do talk to Krishna, what do I talk about? Do I talk just about me? Oh, Krishna, my stomach's hurting. Do you think you could help me out with that? And, you know, we don't have enough money to pay the gas bill. You think you could help me out with that? And, you know, there's this person I do service with, and I didn't like the way they talked to me yesterday. You think you could go in their heart and fix them for me, please? And come to them in a dream and tell them how wonderful I am and that they should be nice to me. And, you know, am I just coming to him with my problems? Or do I go to him and say, you know, how are you doing today, Radha Gopinath? What pastimes are you enjoying here? Are you happy with the service that I'm doing? Is there anything you'd like? Is there anything I can do for you? Is there some service I can render? You know, so start to cultivate. If we have something that we believe is our riches, mahadana, tina mahadana. You know, how are we protecting it? Are we cultivating it? Are we meditating on it? Are we trying to increase it? And then if we do that, then we will experience knowing the difference between Krishna and Maya, getting free from the bondage of illusion, and finding satisfaction. And conversely, if I'm not experiencing that, then maybe I'm cultivating the wrong riches. Okay. Questions, comments, corrections, additions, subtractions? Yes. Yes.
But
Oh, very good question. Well, first of all, we have Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So we have descriptions given in the scriptures as to what Krishna likes, what kind of food he likes. Krishna Das Kaviraj gives you lots and lots of menus. And Krishna says, Patram Pushpam Palam Toyam. So there's descriptions in the Shastra. How does Krishna like to be dressed? How does he like to eat? What kind of things does he like to do? That's all there in the scriptures. And also in the writings of the sadhus, of the acharyas, like Rupa Goswami takes the 9 items of devotional service and breaks them up into 64 different things that you can do. And then he gives examples of doing that. And then we see in the lives of the sadhus, they give us examples. And you can look at different sadhus, different saintly persons. You know, if you want to be a lifetime celibate, you can look at the example of Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati. If you want to be a married person, you can look at the example of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. If you're a married person and you don't get along so well with your spouse, you can look at the example of Srila Prabhupada. You know, you get at least 3 different examples that you can look at. How can I serve Krishna in these different situations? And then we have in the Shastra, especially Chaitanya Charitamrita, different devotees who are showing us different examples of what they did. And then we have guru. So a guru means Diksha Guru and Shiksha Gurus. So those are people that you should consult with that can help you, that can say, you can go to them and say, I'm thinking about doing this, and it's in the Shastra, it's done by the sadhus, is it right for me? And is it right for me now? And you can consult with them. So that's, you know, first you want to look in the Shastra. So this way that I'm inspired to do, is it supported by the scriptures? Is it supported by the sacred literatures? Of course, that's a little tricky because, as we were saying, the Shastra supports many different ways. They support a direct path. They support a gradual path. They support even sidelines that'll keep you within the realm. But you've got to at least make sure it's in the Shastra. Then you look at the saintly persons. What do they do? What example are they setting? How does the saintly persons take the Shastra and live it? And what instruction are the saintly persons giving? That narrows it considerably. And then, okay, people that I need to have people in my life who can guide me, who can give me some personal instruction. I mean, in one sense, the sadhus are also gurus. In one sense, everything in life can be a guru, the trees, the animals, we can learn from everything. Prabhupada said, even an illiterate person by studying nature can learn so much of God and what to do. And ultimately, you learn by the result, although you don't want to have that as your only test because that would, you'd have a lot of suffering and it would take you a long time to figure things out. But you can at least see in the beginning, you know, when I start on a certain path, am I becoming more attached to Krishna? Am I becoming free from illusion? Am I becoming deeply spiritually satisfied? Am I developing the qualities of the mode of goodness? I mean, the ultimate issue, that's your test. And the ultimate issue, you know, you have to see, okay, this is what I understand to be the instructions of the Shastra. This is what I understand to be the examples of the sadhus. This is how I understand the instructions of my gurus. But as soon as I do it, all of a sudden I'm forgetting about Krishna and I'm just criticizing other people all the time and I'm always in anxiety and, you know, then you have to go, wait, but there's something I didn't understand right. There's something I'm not doing it right. There's some... Does that make sense? You know, you've got your cookbooks and you've got your cooks and you get your cooking classes. But if you do it and it's all, you taste it and you go, oh my God. Then you say, wait a minute, I didn't do something right. What did I do wrong? And you go back to your teachers and you say, wait a minute, something's not right here. And then they'd say, no, you were supposed to roast it before you ground it up. Oh, okay. Now I say, what did you do? I did this. Oh, not like that. Is that... Yes, Prabhu. Well, I don't know. If someone's going to talk to their deity very intimately, they probably shouldn't do it when you're around. If I'm going to have an intimate conversation with somebody, then I probably don't want a whole lot of other people around. So I think there's something funny to have to reveal, you know, even with just other jivas. If I'm going to reveal my mind in confidence to my best friend, then I only want other people around who are in the same mood. That's a private thing. If I'm revealing my mind in confidence out loud in front of everybody, there's something really peculiar about that, I would think. And I would question the motives of somebody doing that. And talking, there's a way to talk to Krishna. Also, that's given in the Shastras. You know, we have all the prayers of the Acharyas, like Jamuna used to love to sing all those prayers. And you can certainly find some way to reveal your mind a lot of those prayers are, how can I serve you? How can I devote myself to you? And you'll find that the prayers in the Shastra usually start out with some sort of glorification of Krishna. It's not just like, hey, buddy. You know, they start out with, you're the master of the modes of material nature. You're the supreme personality of Godhead. Everything is resting on you. And then they go to their own personal. So there's a particular etiquette. I mean, we don't find that the cowherd boys do that generally, but there is some sort of etiquette, and then there's the prayers of the Acharya. So if we want, thank you for bringing this up. So if we want to learn how to talk to Krishna, we should learn from the Shastra and from the sadhus, not just make something up. Because that indicates how Krishna wants to be talked to. But the point is that we should be having a relationship with Krishna, and having a relationship with Krishna where we care about Krishna, not just having a relationship with Krishna where I care about me. Does that make sense? Not just that I go to Krishna and talk about me. Either that I don't talk to Krishna, it's like, okay, here's Radha Gopinath, yes, okay, offered my obeisances, did my little religious ritual. Because Prabhupada says Krishna's eager to talk to you. He says that, doesn't he say that? Right? Over and over again? That Krishna's eager, just read that again this morning. That Krishna's eager to talk to you. So if he's actually eager to talk to us, and let's just take this, that what Prabhupada says is true. Can we accept this at least theoretically as true? Okay. That Krishna's eager to, that would mean every one of us. That means that Radha Gopinath, Jagannath, Balaram, Gornitai, that they're excited. What does eager mean? They're excited. They're desiring. They're anticipating. For each one of us, I really have something I want to tell you. You ever feel like that about somebody? Are you ever eager to talk to somebody? You really want to tell them something, and sometimes they're ignoring you. Have you ever had that happen? Where they're surrounded by another 10 people, and you're like, oh, it's not going to work. It just happened to me in Chaupati. I had to tell Radhanath Mara something, and it was really hard. It's just, you know, and one of the devotees said, did you get to talk to him yet? I said, no. He said there was this, you know, 50-person thick circle around him. I finally, I did get to speak to him when we all took prasadam together. But, you know, that feeling that I really want to talk to somebody, and they're somehow, they're inaccessible. They're ignoring me, or they're busy with something else. So if that's how Krishna feels, then what can I do to make myself available? So, of course, chanting Hare Krishna is talking to Krishna. The prayers that we're saying are all talking to Krishna. But it depends what my mood is. If that's my mood, then I'm talking to Krishna, saying the prayers of the Acharyas. But I was talking more about a mood more than specific words. That one should have a mood that I want to communicate with Krishna, and that I want to communicate with him about him. Not just like he's Santa Claus and I'm bringing my list of what I want for Christmas. You know, or what I'm complaining. It's not just, he's just not just my complaint department, you know. But I'm concerned about him and his happiness. Is that all right? Thank you for bringing that up. I don't know. You have to ask him. Can Jai Bhadrabhu ask something? No. Okay, thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Next time.
Amen.